back in the news once again. Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, February 28, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Marco Rubio, the former Republican senator from Florida, who is now the Secretary of State for the Trump administration. And as Secretary of State, his trip to Latin America recently to meet various leaders was met with a variety of corrupt, acquiescent leaders, along with public protest. And so with us on the show today, once again, is Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article on Substack is entitled "Designating Gang Cartels as Terrorist Groups is Pointless," which points to a lot of things directed to Marco Rubio, among other articles that Arturo has written about Rubio recently. But in the meantime, welcome back to the show, Arturo Dominguez.
Man, I appreciate you having me, Oscar. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you on as well. So let's begin by laying out what we have with Marco Rubio. We have in front of us a xenophobic son of Cuban immigrants, originally from Florida, who has espoused a series of what can be seen as white nationalist views numerous times throughout the course of his career. And this was before he became Secretary of State. Now, you've written several articles recently on your Substack page, and one of which was his recent trip to Latin America. And he went to a variety of countries. You know, two of them come to mind, which is Guatemala and the Dominican Republic. But with that in mind, could you give us your analysis of his recent trip and sort of highlight some of the highlights or lowlights, if you will, in places like Guatemala and the Dominican Republic, and even Panama in particular, especially when the whole ridiculous story of the Panama Canal back in the news once again?
Yeah. So, you know, Rubio's trip to Latin America was, it was a lot of the same, like what happened in Colombia, where President Petro in Colombia wanted a Colombian migrants to be sent on Colombian planes, right? And they wanted them treated humanely because Trump was sending Colombians on military planes. Petro refused planes because he wanted the Colombians treated humanely. So there came the whole battle of tariffs and all this stuff. And in the end, Trump claimed victory over Colombia. But when you really look at it, Petro got what he wanted. So, you know, now you got Colombian planes picking up Colombians, being flown home, not handcuffed, being treated humanely, given food and water, things like that. When you look at Rubio's trip and Latin America in general, that's essentially their overall narrative. So like the deal with Guatemala to accept migrants, that was a deal that was already in place. On average, Guatemala is receiving 6 to 7 flights of migrants from the U.S. per week. To bump that up 40%, like they agreed, now they're getting 10 flights per week. So while it sounds like a big deal on paper, when it comes to the number of migrants, it really isn't. What happens with migrants that get sent to places like Guatemala is they essentially sit there and wait until they either get repatriated back home or are granted a path to like residency in the region. Essentially, Guatemala acts as a deportation mechanism for the United States, and we pay them for that. It's not like they do this for free. And then, you know, it's the same with Mexico. You know, we pay them billions of dollars a year. They try to prevent caravans at their southern border. The deal with like Nayib Bukele, which is, you know, kind of right up, like right up Trump's alley, right? Same kind of far right, authoritarian type guy. He's a great speaker, very charismatic. A lot of people love him because of the crime rate dropping so drastically in El Salvador. But, you know, there's a lot of reason for that. A lot of innocent people get thrown in jail. There's a lot of human rights issues involved with what he's doing. So, you know, you have to strike a balance there. But when it came to Rubio, it was almost like some sort of romantic meeting, you know, between them two. And, you know, the offer to accept, you know, criminals from the U.S. and like Bukele said, was outsource some of our prison system to El Salvador. You know, obviously, I think Rubio said this too. There's constitutional issues with that. We have laws. We can't just send our criminals to another country like that. You know, we're talking like violent offenders who are on death rows and stuff like that. We can't just send them to El Salvador. It just doesn't work that way. So, yeah, you know, his overall trip, like I said, it kind of has this narrative of Donald Trump or the Trump administration saying that they secured all these deals and all these agreements immigration wise, but all of those agreements were already in place. You know, the 10,000 troops at the Mexican border, there was already 15,000 there when that deal was made. You know, so the Dominican Republic, nothing really happened there except for they seized Maduro's plane again. And I think they tried to portray it as a second plane. But when you look at the images from the New York Times, when they seized the original plane under Biden, and you look at the images of the plane that Marco Rubio and then put a big sticker on the door, it's the same plane. You can't see the call numbers on it, but the painting, the pinstriping, it's the same model plane, same stripes, same everything. So it was basically the Dominican Republic is really close to the U.S. government, regardless of presidents. And, you know, they do play a role in what we do in Haiti and
yes,
things like that. So with the Dominican Republic, what I found curious was they agreed to allow, they said a singular agent, Customs and Border Patrol agent, which I don't know about just one, but they said an agent would be put in the Dominican Republic to help them with like border surveillance and with some of the technologies we use on our border to put at the border between the DR and Haiti. So, you know, not a lot really went on there, but aside from those two things, those were the two biggest deals. But as far as the rest of Latin America, like I said, it's that narrative, you know, where it was a messaging deal. You know, they go down there, they pretend to secure deals that are already in place, and the United States is paying for them. So it was really, to me, I felt like what Rubio did in Latin America could have been handled via email or, you know, a Skype or something like that. I don't know that he had to fly to all these countries and do all, I mean, I guess you have to if you're the State Department guy, but these deals seem like something that could have happened over email.
Yeah, it's this strange combination of legitimate extortion by Marco Rubio on behalf of the Trump administration, along with this, as you say, comical collection of posturing and window dressing that we saw during the course of some of these trips. But the anger from the public in some of these countries is very legit, especially in Panama, where people are profoundly upset with regards to the idea of the U.S. retaking the Panama Canal. There were even flag burnings as well when Rubio visited the country. Imagine what would happen if Trump were to visit Panama around the same time as well. And so let's go to the issue of El Salvador, because that's so extraordinary, because for years we've been hearing stories about migrants being sent to Guantanamo Bay as far back as the early 90s. And that's to be polite right there with regards to Haitian migrants, which is where the Dominican Republic comes into play, because the Dominican Republic has this long, dark history of institutional racism towards Haiti. And so it would make sense for Marco Rubio to be buddy-buddy with whatever government is in power in the Dominican Republic. But man, El Salvador, it embarrasses me profoundly that the president down there, who, by the way, is still illegitimate because he's running a second term, even though the Constitution says he can only have one term, would even agree to the idea of not only sending, you know, Salvadoran migrants to this mega prison without any trial or any proof of their criminality, but also U.S. citizens as well. I know you mentioned this in passing, but we need to expand on this, because that is insane, not only internationally illegal, but just profoundly insane. I know that Bukele is buddy-buddy with the Trump administration, but my goodness, I mean, I still have a hard time trying to wrap my head around that issue.
Yeah, you know, and essentially, when it comes to these type of agreements, the United States is outsourcing its liability, you know, for immigrants, humane treatment or inhumane treatment of them. Look at Mexico, for example, where they have Mexican military at its southern border and they stop these caravans. A lot of people do end up getting arrested. They get thrown into the Mexican immigration system, and there's been reports of inhumane treatment down there. When you look at that, it's just one under national border south of us. Those migrants who are being detained in Mexico would have otherwise been detained in the U.S., and we're essentially just outsourcing the inhumanity to Mexico. This is the same thing with Bukele, right? El Salvador is still, if I'm not mistaken, under martial law. So,
yes,
you know, a lot of people's rights are suspended, and he's making a lot of moves, like you said, to run for another term, constitutional reforms, reforming the whole government there. And it's leading towards authoritarian type of control. And, you know, who's to say that he's, once he figures out, you know, gets his second term in, that he's like Trump, he's just not going to go away. You know, Trump has no intention of leaving office after 4 years. I'm not saying he won't. He just doesn't have any intention of leaving. And, you know, Bukele's the same way. And he is very popular because El Salvador is so much safer. But at what expense? You know, if we start sending migrants down there into a country where there's martial law, right? And they're building these mega prisons that El Salvador can't afford to keep operating the way they're doing it now. You know, I've heard reports of these gang members' families having to provide them with food if they want them to eat while they're in prison. Otherwise, they get one meal a day of like beans or something like that. So it's not sustainable for El Salvador to keep running these massive prisons. And we would be, like they said, we would be paying El Salvador a small sum. Well, small is a relative term when you're talking about money between countries, right? We could be, small sum could be $40 billion, you know, a year or whatever, because to Bukele and his joint press conference with Rubio, he mentioned that the money El Salvador would receive from the U.S. to house our migrants or our criminals would help keep their prison system funded. And that was a red flag. So I started looking into it, and it's just not sustainable for El Salvador to maintain the prisons that they have now. And for them to accept prisoners from other countries, even charging for it, it just doesn't seem sustainable. You're just making the problem bigger. So what I think that inevitably, yeah, some of what Nayib Bukele can be construed as good because it's safer. Again, I think it's not sustainable. I think at some point it's going to start faltering. And if he's too focused on, which it seems to me, he's too focused on staying in power than anything else, he's not going to see it coming. And all this praise he's receiving now is going to turn to ire. People are going to turn against him. And I mean, you know, El Salvador may be doing better economically and all kinds of things, but when you really take a look at it from the outside looking in, it seems like it's just teetering on the brink of, you know, outright failure. And I don't know that Nayib Bukele is seeing that. You know, he's too busy drifting further and further to the right. He's trying to cozy up to people like Trump because there's money involved. There are a lot of issues with El Salvador, and this offer that Bukele made just speaks to his level of authoritarian type of thinking.
And again, this is against international law to house right. U.S. citizens in a foreign prison. And not only is it illegal, but if we look at it in the larger picture, it almost seems like he's playing with fire here. Because, because one of the things that I have on my to-do list this year is to break down or demystify the issue of Tren de Aragua, which is this gang from Venezuela who's become the new boogeyman in corporate media and amongst Trump supporters from Venezuela. Now, what is MS-13 but a gang that developed in the U.S. prison system? What is Tren de Aragua but a gang that developed in Venezuela's prison system? And if you look at those two together, what we can conclude is that prisons, you know, are not necessarily a means of punishment, but rather a means for organized crime to better network amongst themselves in order to get powerful. And so to have those two organizations in the same prison, you are really playing with fire. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In regards to a real powder keg of a problem that's not going to explode in the U.S., but rather in El Salvador because of this insane deal made by Nayib Bukele, who, once again, I have to say this, under the state of exception, is an illegitimate president making these decisions in El Salvador, and it's the Salvadoran people that are going to pay the price. But I digress a little bit too much from the subject here, because obviously here in the U.S., the issue of U.S. aid has been in the headlines lately because of Elon Musk's defunding of various government programs and humanitarian programs as well. However, in one of your recent Substack articles, you rightly mention that U.S. aid has a dark history of undermining democracies in Latin America and the Caribbean that still remains relevant today. But while all this is going on, Marco Rubio declared himself the head of U.S. aid. So what is the motivation behind Rubio getting involved in an organization that he has supported in the past, but now deems it unnecessary? CNN actually pulled up a tweet from Marco Rubio back in 2017 supporting USAID, but now he's against it because he's with the Trump administration and Elon Musk has deemed it unnecessary, USAID. But again, there's a complicated nuance juxtaposition here that needs further understanding, right?
Yeah, you know, first of all, Marco Rubio's not a principled guy, right? He doesn't have really any principles that he stands by. He, you know, his trip to Latin America was, and this ties into the whole USAID thing, the trip to Latin America was this whole mentality, this was the narrative they presented before he left, was this idea of do as we say or there will be consequences, right? And that's the narrative.
Extortion.
Right. And that's the narrative that the Trump administration went with, despite there not being any actual real tangible deals being made. So when it comes to the USAID situation and tying it together with the State Department, there are immediate conflicts of interest. This is why these two agencies were separate, because there was supposed to at least be a perception of division between the two, right? So you don't have the State Department, ideally, you don't want the State Department going to another country and saying, we want basically your mineral rights, like we're doing to Ukraine right now. We want your mineral rights and we'll give you aid. No mineral rights, no aid, right? And the State Department is not supposed to technically have that position, even though they kind of do in a more bureaucratic, indirect way. Putting USAID under the State Department gives them that sort of authority from the beginning, from the front. The American public sees it. And for a lot of people in Trump world, they think that this is a fair idea. They think that this is justified, that we should be able to go into Africa or anywhere in Latin America and hold their economies hostage in exchange for aid. you know, with that said, it's not like USAID was some sort of benevolent institution before, right? Yes, they exactly. did do a lot of good things. They do a lot of good things with food aid, with tackling AIDS, with all these things. But USAID in all their documentation always mentions that it's an influence operation, essentially. They also use those two words together, influence operation. But that's the point. The point is to make the United States look good in the eyes of the rest of the world. And essentially, when that doesn't work, they use those same programs, the aid programs and tackling AIDS, to send people into countries to try to foment division, to try to create uprisings. You know, in 2014, it might have been 04, I can't remember exactly when, but they did this in Cuba. And it was under Obama. So, yeah, 2014. And what's her name, who was all over the news? I don't know why I can't remember her name all of a sudden, but she was all over the news trying to, you know, talk about all the good things USAID did. But Samantha Powers, the one behind this operation to send young people from Latin America, including Venezuela, Nicaragua, El Salvador, into Cuba under the guise of helping them tackle AIDS, which Cuba doesn't really have that big of an issue with AIDS, like they try to say it does. And instead of being there to do that, they were there trying to create uprisings, to create organized little groups to try to overthrow the government. So, as I said, it's not really a benevolent institution. It's a transactional institution. So putting USAID under State Department control is hugely problematic for every reason I just mentioned, because now you have the power of the State Department, who negotiates foreign trade deals, who negotiates peace deals and all these things, who can use aid now and hang it over people. Like, you know, you take Palestine, for example. Marco Rubio was just recently in Israel, and now he can dangle aid over the Palestinian Authority, right? And
before you continue, it's actually funny that you mentioned Samantha Power, because she did write an article for the New York Times earlier this month speaking about the virtues of USAID, but not mentioning any of the underlying issues that you just described that give USAID its dark history. But please continue on, Israel.
So, yeah. So now, you know, you have the Palestinian Authority, you know, on the West Bank and stuff, and a lot of people consider them sellouts because of, you know, they're allowing Israel to do a lot of things and they're targeting the Palestinian resistance and stuff. But, you know, Marco Rubio can hang aid over Palestinians to try to get a deal done. You know, you go to any country in Africa where there's a civil war, now the State Department can go negotiate and use food as a negotiating tool. And that's a violation of international law. You know, so you're not supposed to be able to use food as a negotiating tool for peace. Or, you know, you want us to stop dropping bombs, you want aid, then you're going to have to agree to that. You just can't do that. You know, it's
once again, extortion.
Right. It's extortion. Right. And this is the whole peace through strength strategy that the administration keeps talking about. And essentially is peace through strength translates into, we're going to be the bully. You want peace, just take it. You know, don't fight back. And that's how I see that.
Only the strong survive.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So going back to Rubio being the head of USAID, I'm curious to know if you see the same irony as I do of a right-wing Cuban American being the head of an organization that has a history of undermining democracies in Haiti, Venezuela, and including Cuba as well. I mean, I agree with you that he doesn't have any principles really, but nonetheless, I feel like that's one of the motivations as well to like sink his teeth into USAID to a certain degree.
This is a double-edged sword for Rubio, because USAID pays for a lot of the U.S. propaganda media that Cubans receive, whether it's radio, you know, through the airwaves, bootleg type of stuff. And a lot of anti-Cuban media outlets are funded with USAID money under the guise of promoting democracy. So for Rubio, you would think he wants to do this, right? Like, I think it's Cyber Cuba, there's Radio Marti, you know, things like that. There's a lot of media outlets that have been around for a long time, for decades, that are funded by USAID money, used to be funded with CIA money. But, you know, you would think Rubio would want to keep those things. But many people in the Trump administration started seeing these programs that were funding media outlets, and they called it state-run media. They called it U.S. state-run media, and that's what it is. You know, that's what it boils down to. You know, they're giving these small little website outlets that have millions of views per month, $500,000, you know, a year, and that's enough to fund the two or three journalists that are working from home and pushing propaganda all over Facebook and stuff like that. So, and that's what it boils down to, is state-run media. But on the other end of that double-edged sword is now Rubio has power to use USAID in the way that he wants. And with these crackdowns that he's putting on Cuba, for example, because you notice how they're negotiating with Venezuela, right? They went down there, they talked to Maduro, they let Chevron sign another 6-month contract to, you know, import Venezuelan oil to the U.S. And Maduro gave up, you know, some people that were in jail. And no, they weren't hostages. I know at least three of those people that Maduro released were recently arrested as part of those weapons shipments that were intercepted, U.S. military weapons that were intercepted coming into Venezuela. I know three of those six guys were caught as part of that. So Venezuela got what it wanted. Maduro got what he wanted. 6 more months of being able to sell oil to Chevron. That's keeping the economy afloat right now in Venezuela. And that's one of the reasons the economy is doing so well. And Trump just let it happen. Then you go to Cuba and all of a sudden it's, you know, drop a hammer, you know, put them back on the state sponsor of terror list. Rubio threw so many sanctions that Cuba hasn't seen in 15, 20 years on them. And then on Tuesday, he issued a memorandum saying that anybody who participates in the Cuban labor program, which is essentially, you know, the doctors that go all over the world, there's 30,000 Cuban doctors all over the world. And he's saying they're going to sanction anyone, including foreign government officials, who participate in allowing Cuban doctors to work in their countries. So, you know, there's some in Italy. Rubio wants to start sanctioning Italian government officials who are allowing Cubans into their country. So he's really going in hard on Cuba. And, you know, we already know that when it comes to sending food aid to Cuba, you know, they get about 5 pounds of chicken per person per month from the U.S. And that's basically it. And hardly anybody can survive on that. So that is essentially what Israel was doing to Palestine when they're letting just enough calories to go in to keep people alive. Again, another violation of international law because it's collective punishment. And that's what Rubio is doing right now in the Trump administration is doing now. And, you know, that's essentially what the U.S. has been doing for 60 years.
Exactly. And this idea of punishing countries for having Cuban doctors is almost like charging people with 6 degrees of separation. It's so absurd and so far-reaching. It makes no sense other than a white nationalist agenda that we're going to get deeper into in the second half of this conversation. But in the meantime, we're speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article on Substack is entitled "Designating Gangs and Cartels as Terrorist Groups is Pointless." This is a Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Lucifer, son of the morning, I'm going to chase you out of earth. Shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Satan is an evil man, but him can't show.
That was Max Romeo, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC_shill. And, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're focusing on Marco Rubio, the new Secretary of State under the Trump administration, with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article on Substack is entitled "Designating Gangs and Cartels as Terrorist Groups is Pointless." So, Arturo, let's get to the issue of Mexico. We mentioned it a little bit in passing, but let's turn our attention here specifically with the U.S. designating drug cartels as terrorist organizations, which I mentioned with regards to your recent article. In addition to that, during Rubio's confirmation hearing last year, he was asked about the idea of the U.S. invading Mexico. And here was his response to Republican Senator Dave McCormick during his line of questioning. So let's take a listen.
What about military force?
Well, that's an option the president has at his disposal. Obviously, it's not one that is in the purview of the Department of State. Yeah. I think President Trump is someone that never publicly discusses his options and leaves himself the flexibility to act. I think there's a lot we can and will continue to do in close partnership with our allies in Mexico. I think there's more they can do as well to confront this challenge. And my preference would be, from the Department of State's perspective, my preference would be that we can work with the Mexicans on this issue cooperatively, because it is impacting their nation as much as ours. These sophisticated groups, these criminal organizations, don't simply threaten America, they threaten the Mexican political process.
So that was Marco Rubio sort of, maybe, kind of not really answering the question of whether or not the idea of invading Mexico is off the table. Now, there's a lot to unpack there. One thing I would say is the idea of the U.S. cooperating with Mexico. We saw that during the Enrique Peña Nieto administration in Mexico, around the same time as the Ayotzinapa disappearances of several students by the state of Mexico. And even as we have this conversation right now, Arturo, the former, I guess, Mexican equivalent of the Homeland Security Director, Genaro García Luna, is in jail for a variety of reasons. Chief among them is drug trafficking. And this is somebody that the U.S. supported both in Republican and Democratic administrations. So with that said, though, I mean, what are your thoughts here on this designation and this idea of the U.S. sort of playing with fire, even leaving open the idea of invading Mexico?
Marco Rubio was pretty smart in his response. I'll give him that at his confirmation hearing. The telling part was that it seemed like he would prefer not to use military force. You know, in the Senate confirmation hearing, he talked about what designating the cartels as terrorist groups could allow him to do. And essentially, it's sanction, right? it doesn't grant the U.S. any power to go and invade a sovereign nation. That said, you have Pete Hegseth at DOD, who has this really dangerous and probably unhealthy obsession with the border because he's military, right? So that's not his normally his concern. But after wokeism and DEI, the border is his priority. And when everybody keeps asking him, Hegseth, about our posture militarily around the world, he can't talk about that without talking about the border. And that scares me, right? So, you know, designating cartels as terrorist groups, when Rubio did that the other day or last week, he essentially was only allowed to sanction, right? So he sanctioned certain members of the cartels and some of their families, and those sanctions, they said that they intended to target cartel assets in the U.S., but they didn't specify what that meant. Is that meant like bank accounts, money, or real estate? It didn't specify, and there hasn't been any news of any of that stuff happening. So at this point, it's pretty safe to say that they don't have much they could take from the cartels that are here in the U.S., but the sanctioning of cartel bosses and stuff essentially are visa restrictions. They're not allowed to come to the U.S. You know, just the same kind of sanctions they put on Maduro, which, you know, he's not coming here unless it's for a UN thing. So it doesn't really affect him, or it doesn't really affect the cartels. The thing is, again, you go back to Hegseth, right? And I covered this little press scrum he did when he was at AFRICOM in Germany, that African command over there. And he had said, and this bothered me because he said he wanted to get Trump to allow him and four-star generals to make decisions to conduct drone strikes and kill suspected terrorists without having to rely on a decision from the president. So one of the things Obama was criticized for back in the day was that he signed off on every drone strike. And essentially, every time a family was killed, his name was on the order. When they bombed a wedding, his name was on the order. What Hegseth wants to do is he wants to take that authority from Trump and give it to himself. Okay, so now you have Hegseth with this ability to target and kill suspected terrorists. Now you just designated cartels as terrorists. We're seeing the reports of more CIA drone flights into Mexico, and those are with the Mexican government's participation, right? There's an agreement there. Claudia Sheinbaum emphasized that she's allowing these surveillance drones to come in because they're giving that information to the Mexican military so they can target cartels. So it's useful information for their government. So she agreed to it. However, you give Hegseth that kind of power and an administration-wide disregard for the sovereignty of Mexico or any other country south of our border, I know we're several steps away from Hegseth ordering a drone strike in Mexico, but we're not as far away from that as you would like to think. Because according to Hegseth, at that presser, when he walked out of AFRICOM in Germany, he said that the drone strike, I believe it was in Nigeria, it had happened 2 days before that. He said that that was an example of taking the handcuffs off and allowing generals and people like him to make these decisions. So he kind of hinted at the fact that he already has that authority to say he's a designated terrorist and wherever, we're going to drop a bomb on him, and they do it. And that's where it starts getting bothersome for me. Designating cartels as terrorist groups is pointless because of the limitations that the State Department has. However, it does send a message of, you know, this is kind of where we're headed. It's manufacturing consent. It's normalizing the conversation about actually sending drones or special forces into Mexico. That said, Claudia Sheinbaum said she would never allow that. She would defend Mexico's sovereignty with everything they had. And I've read some stuff from some foreign policy analysts that said, essentially, if you send special forces troops into Mexico without support from the Mexican government, they're blind. Once they're on the ground, they're blind. drones can only do so much for them. And without support of the Mexican government or the locals, they're not going to get very far. I find a little bit of peace in that, knowing that, you know, Claudia Sheinbaum isn't going to willingly allow these things to happen. But again, you're talking about guys like Hegseth and Stephen Miller and Marco Rubio, and none of these people have any respect for the sovereignty of our neighbors, whether allies or not. I mean, look at how they're walking all over Ukraine, you know, look at how they're talking to our European partners. If they're treating them like that openly, imagine how they're going to treat the governments they don't like. So I think we're at a very critical point where we really have to start paying attention to the little things the administration is doing to try to move us closer towards normalizing the idea of drone strikes in Mexico, because that's a scary thought.
It's madness. And even if it's just posturing, it's still madness that this idea seems to be growing. I remember it was either 2023 or 2024 when Rolling Stone magazine came out with these leaked documents of the idea or plans of the U.S. invading Mexico by Trump's staffers or Trump's advisors. And since then, in the past month alone, it seems that there are numerous articles out there saying that, hey, this might actually happen, and God forbid, because it would be nothing short of catastrophic for both countries' economies, but untold number of people who would be victims of this sort of madness. And this madness, I cannot stress that enough, is being underlined by white nationalism. There's no other way about it. You mentioned Pete Hegseth and Stephen Miller and Marco Rubio. There is no distinction between any of them with regards to their white nationalist motivations. And that is especially true for Marco Rubio. Even if he is Latino, even if he does look like you and I, he is a white nationalist, plain and simple. His record, even before he became Secretary of State, proves that as well. And so this brings up to what has been underlying a lot of the decisions that Marco Rubio has made with regards to his position as Secretary of State in some of the places he's visited recently, including Gaza. I mean, we could argue that the way that Israel looks at Gaza right now as beachfront property is no different from the way that the Trump administration is looking at the Panama Canal. And Marco Rubio is a vessel to pushing those sort of ideas and agendas, no matter how insane they are. And so that sort of leads me into something that you've been working on, which is trying to count the number of open white supremacists or white nationalists that are in the current Trump administration. And I just got to say this, since you mentioned this to me before we started recording, is that it's hard to keep up. There's so many. It's staggering. And there's no ambiguity about a lot of these people. Stephen Miller may be number one. You could put Marco Rubio in there. And under any other circumstance, I would put Stephen Miller at number one. But right now, it seems like it's Elon Musk at number one as being the white nationalist of this organization, for the simple fact that he seems to be more in charge of the country than Donald Trump himself. So this is something that you're working on right now. How many names is it possible that you could think of, or what else do you want to point out with regards to this staggering number of white nationalists in this administration, including Marco Rubio?
Yeah, so, you know, I started with, you know, people in the highest offices, and, you know, you have your Kristi Noem, you have Pete Hegseth, Marco Rubio, now you have Cash Patel, you have Dan Bongino, just like nonstop, flooding in. And at the moment, I have 18 to 20 on my list. And, you know, I'm starting to look beyond just the heads of departments and organizations. But, you know, I can't get past the overall white nationalist attitude of the administration. And let's be clear, it's a Christian white nationalist attitude. And, yes, you know, the most prominent Christian white nationalist this country has ever seen was the KKK. And when you see what these people are doing, and you look back through the KKK, the similarities are just way too many to ignore. So there was the attacks on DEI on day one for everybody, right? For Kristi Noem, for Marco Rubio, for Hegseth, for everybody. And following that came the firings of qualified people to be replaced by white men, unqualified white men. So, you know, you look at who was head of the Department of Defense before Pete Hegseth, right? A highly decorated 4-star general, black man, had all the attributes you need for that job, all the requirements. He fit the bill times 10. And then you replace him with this mediocre white guy who was a Fox host on, hosted Fox and Friends on the weekends. Like, come on, man. So then Hegseth is in there.
We have an alcohol problem.
Right. Hegseth is in there. He fired, what was his name? General C.Q. Brown. He was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, another highly decorated black man. And Trump wants to replace him with a white guy who requires waivers from the president to do the job. This is what merit-based means to them. Merit-based is white and male. Hegseth also fired the woman, the admiral, who was also on the Joint Chiefs. She spent more than 20 plus years commandeering a battleship, 2 aircraft fleets. Like, you know, she had all the credentials. Got rid of her because right before Hegseth, or when she got the job, he said she was basically a DEI hire, that she only got the job because she's a woman. So it was, you know, when he fired her, I'm like, well, there you go. You know, he's going to fire Admiral Franchetti because he says she's a woman. She got the job because she's a woman. Forget the fact that she's probably the most decorated woman ever in the U.S. Navy. And you know, who knows who those people are going to be replaced with. He also fired all the judge advocate generals from every military, the Army, Navy, like all of them, they're gone. No more judge advocate generals. So, you know, it's just like firing all the OIGs, right? The inspector generals for each respective agency. Trump administration did that on day one. So now instead of having them auditing and holding these agencies accountable, you have the neo-fascist Elon Musk doing the job of, I don't know, 50 agencies out of 20 agencies. There's so many inspector generals. And it's just interesting because, again, to them, merit-based is white and male. And that's what we're seeing across the board with very few exceptions. You have Kristi Noem, right? She's a white nationalist. She just happens to be a woman, right? She fits the bill. She's going to do everything that Trump and the administration wants to do. And so far, for her, she's done nothing but do propaganda, right? She's going around with a bulletproof vest, taking pictures, doing videos. You know, she made that video. It made me laugh because I thought of, remember when Kamala Harris went to Latin America and told everybody don't come?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the whole root causes. Yeah, that's real genius. Anyway, Kristi Noem is putting out videos now telling migrants to self-deport or we're going to come get you. And they're in English and Spanish, and they're supposed to run on, I don't know, they, Homeland Security said they spent.
Even Rubio did the same thing.
Right. Yeah, right, right. They called it a multi-million dollar ad buy to run these 1-minute ads telling migrants to basically get out. And I laughed because I thought to myself, that's about as effective as going to Latin America and saying, don't come, you know, because, you know, they're going to laugh. It's just a broad white nationalist platform altogether in the administration. And they're doing so much at the same time. And so much of it is outlandish. And you're trying to figure out what's real and what isn't because they're flooding the news cycle on purpose. So you hear Donald Trump say he wants to buy Gaza or whatever, turn it into a resort. And you're thinking that's just, at first you're like, he's just talking. They're just trying to stir up stuff to keep the news cycle busy. Then Marco Rubio goes to Israel, makes 3 stops, does 3 press conferences in a day on his way to Saudi Arabia to meet with the Russians. And in each of the 3 stops, he said that he's there to try to help implement Trump's plans for it, because they're bold. They've never been talked about before. That this is how we're going to achieve peace in the Middle East by displacing 2 million people and just sending them on their way and never letting them come back. That's what he's talking about. And I was a little bit taken aback that they were actually considering this as a real solution. And it's one that nobody talks about because it's illegal. It's a violation of about a billion international laws. And the UN has been opposed to this. Most of the world has been opposed to doing such a thing for years. And let's be real. As long as we keep giving Israel weapons and allowing them to do what they do without consequence, there won't be peace in the Middle East. Even if you sent every Palestinian, there won't be peace in the Middle East.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there and a lot to discuss in future conversations. But I will say this about both Trump and Rubio, that while Rubio may be a vessel for Trump's agenda, when it comes to white nationalism, as we've discussed, he is a firm believer, and he has been a firm believer of white nationalism even before he became Secretary of State. With regards to Trump, people may sometimes compare him to Hitler or the new Hitler. No, Donald Trump is not Hitler. He is not the new Hitler. He is the first Donald Trump. And his name will be used as an epithet in much the same way as Hitler or Mussolini. Is Marco Rubio the next Henry Kissinger? No, he is the first Marco Rubio. And I think history, as long as he continues to push and impose the Trump agenda through extortion and various other illegal means, people in Latin America are going to use his name as an epitaph in much the same way as we look at Kissinger and his history throughout various parts throughout the world. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. His recent article on Substack is entitled "Designating Gangs and Cartels as Terrorist Groups is Pointless." And we're going to try to create a link to his article on our Twitter account. But as always, Arturo Dominguez, it's always informative and insightful. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Man, I appreciate it, Oscar. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, February 28th. Here are some headlines. Negotiations between Israel and Hamas on the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire have begun in Cairo, Egyptian officials say, before tomorrow's expiration of the truce's first phase. Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said an Israeli delegation has traveled to Egypt to see whether there is enough common ground to negotiate an extension to the deal. Hamas has called on the international community to put pressure on Israel, quote, to immediately enter the second phase of the Gaza ceasefire agreement without any delay or hesitation, close quote. Meanwhile, an Arab summit meeting in Cairo next week will aim to devise an action plan for Gaza's future without the displacement of Palestinians that Donald Trump has called for. Secretary General Antonio Guterres today said he will be attending the meeting on Tuesday and stressed that the fragile ceasefire in Gaza must hold. This comes as Gaza's health ministry has confirmed over 48,000 Palestinian deaths in Israel's war on Gaza. That number is expected to be significantly higher as bodies are found under the rubble. In domestic news, a federal judge in San Francisco ruled yesterday that the Office of Personnel Management Directives telling federal agencies to fire their probationary employees were illegal and likely requiring at least some agencies to put a stop to the mass terminations that have been underway across the government. In a case brought by federal unions and advocacy groups, Senior District Judge William Alsup ruled that communications to federal agencies on January 20th and February 14th regarding the termination of probationary workers amounted to illegal directives and held that they have no legal effect with regard to at least six federal agencies. Alsup said he would issue a more detailed ruling in a forthcoming written opinion, but said he felt it was important to issue the substance of his findings right away in light of the fact that the Department of Defense has been planning to start terminating thousands of probationary employees today. The Department of Education yesterday launched a first-of-its-kind portal called, quote, NDEI, close quote, where the public can complain about diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in publicly funded K-12 schools. This comes after the